All right. Well, hello, Matthew. It's good to talk to you again.
Good talk to you again, Sam.
Yeah.
After your sojourn into the class portion of your PhD.
Yeah, so I finished that first year, and most of the coursework is all set. I've got a few more little things to knock out than comprehensives and dissertation part. So it's getting there, but I'm going to miss the class time, because you really do kind of get to know the professors, and a lot of my classes have master's students and PhD students. So, it's kind of a fun little community that we have in our programs, and just that kind of camaraderie of being able to sit down for a few hours, every week and kind of go over
Right.
what you're reading and not just be, a monk about your studies is something I hear is, something you miss after you get done with coursework. So, yeah, getting there.
Like an intentional community. I guess it is an intentional community, a whole bunch of people focused on learning one aspect
It
of a
is.
topic.
Yeah, and the cool thing is, I'm on the East Coast of the US, but the program's over in San Francisco, so it's on the West Coast, and we've got a lot of people there. But there are people in Maine and Missouri, and we've got some folks in Alberta and Edmonton. I thought about you in Montreal, and then we have a couple of people in India and over in what's the other? Is it what's the country? Is it one in Ghana and then one in Rwanda? So,
Wow.
yeah, it's kind of a fun spread across.
All hours of the day then, represent, yeah,
Right.
almost every time zone is covered by your guys as a by your classmates.
Yeah, and I always feel bad for being on the East Coast and saying, oh, that 4 o'clock meeting is actually 7 o'clock our time. But then I think about, the folks in, on the African
In
continent, and
Asia,
it's like,
yeah.
yeah, and especially in Asia, right? So yeah, so it's been a lot of fun. I'm so glad I finally took the plunge and decided to do it.
And what the big bow tie and celebration will be in a couple of years' time then, like a year for your thesis writing and defense, maybe a couple of years.
Hopefully it's going to be I'm turning 47 this year, so the goal is by 50 to have everything knocked out. So I'm definitely hoping to finish it a little early, kind of on a speed run. But it's fun with because we have little children too in our family, so it's fun to be a fellow student along the way with them.
Well, you get what three of Shakespeare's seven stages of life. You got little kids, you got
Right.
like I don't know 20 somethings, you got yourself.
Yeah, I know, old man. So it is cool to see. And that's, I always tell people it's one of those things where if you're wondering about hopping back into it, it's never too late. And I've been reading about a lot of people in their 50s going back to do master's degrees or actually go through undergrad and that kind of stuff because they're having that existential angst. Yeah, and evidently that's on the rise right now as people are putting college off, in their earlier
Right.
days. And
Right.
yeah, I'm glad I did college when I did, but I do wish we had more of sort of like that idea where you go take a year or two, do service or do a trade or something and then come back, because I think that's such a healthy thing.
I saw maybe I encountered recently a East Coast professor, I think at Brown University, Mark Blyth. I think he does economics. He's got a very strong Scottish accent. He had commented that he is what's it called, like a first generation professor, evidently, because of the cost and the time requirements to do undergrad, then graduate or PhD. There's a tendency that people from the posh class, sort of upper class or upper middle class, tend to be the ones who wind up becoming professors because many folks, like myself, are like, okay, I've got a bunch of debt. My parents were lifelong renters. There's no, nothing for me to rely on for a few more
Right.
years, and so, but yeah, that is very cool that you have a more diversity ultimately, right?
Yeah, no,
It's
I'm right there with you though. was the first person in my family to on either side, I think, go to college. And my parents were sort of surprised when I said, "Hey, I want to go to college," when I was in high school. They're like, "Why do you want to go to college?" So I've been swimming up that stream for a long time. But yeah, I hear you on the debt. And then, my wife is a pastor and a teacher, so we're not affluent by any means. But yeah, that idea of having the time and the privilege to be able to hop into these sorts of things and pursuits, it's
Right.
definitely there. But thank goodness, we still have the student loan program a little bit, and stipends and scholarships and all those wonderful things to
Yeah.
float the rest of us who can't just write a check.
Right. Yeah, for sure. Wow.
Well, and
And
that's go ahead. I'm sorry.
oh, yeah, go ahead.
No, I was going to say, I mean, we were talking before our conversation about like kind of early Christianities, and that was one of the things I was thinking of is the socioeconomic factors that play into everything from scholarship to religion, and who's got the time to go join a new cult down the street when you're trying to make ends meet and make sure
Make ends meet.
your children are going to be alive tomorrow, especially in the ancient world. So it's I think there's kind of that strand that runs throughout humanity of those of us foolish enough to hop in and say, no, it's going to work. We can go be pastors, or we can go be social work type minded people, and still pay the bills. But it's not the easiest path, but I think it's worth it when you get to it.
Yeah, I wonder, like this idea of rugged individualism. So my understanding is that in ancient cultures, there generally wasn't a feeling of the individual is more like you're part of X community and part of this tribe or this deme in ancient Athens. We're Athenians, so that means we're part of the Greek community of squabbling nations, and I would imagine that religion, intentional communities, formed around some sort of shared culture or belief, would be the way that you'd have the only way you'd be able to have stability because the government of the empire or whatever, didn't exactly have social programs and other things like that. I think they had the free bread in Rome, but that was mainly so that people wouldn't keep having revolts inside the city that had to be put down. So it was like a
Right.
peacekeeping kind of a thing. It was a, but one thing I read in the Big Gods, a book by a UBC prof out here in British Columbia, a few years back, was that the arrival of state social programs has taken away some of the meaning or necessity for people to be part of faith because. Now you do have a civil service or a government that can help you out, through the cracks, through the harder times in your life. Whereas previously, you would have to go back to your faith group probably, and you'd try and all collect money to help, this one person, and then reciprocate, of course. But
Yeah, I mean that's in Acts in the New Testament, Paul's running around the Mediterranean collecting for the poor in Jerusalem, and
right. Yeah, that's right.
the word he uses there is the ebionim, which is
Yes. The
not a
poor, isn't
poor
it?
yeah, it's not the poor in spirit or the those poor souls. It's literally socioeconomic poor, and we think that meant the early followers of Jesus who were still hanging out in Jerusalem. But I think that was a big part of his missionary zeal there. And whether that was a concession to Peter and the Jerusalem faction of, hey, if y'all give me the sanction here, I'll go out and collect you some money and bring it back every now and then, or not, whatever happened there. But Paul talks about it in his epistles, and it's in there. So yeah, I mean, because ideally, especially in the ancient world, you would have your family, and that family would be there to support you. So if your parents died, or if you came on hard times, you would always have a cousin or an aunt or something that would be able to help support you, or just help you rebound from hard times. And then that became, like you said, kind of a tribal idea, and that morphed into that Roman idea. And of course, in the early church, well into the medieval period, if you were hungry, don't become a bandit on the road. It was like, go find a monastery and they'll give you bread and water at least, or wine. And eventually that kind of morphs into, what we have now. But yeah, the modern aid system, really, I think, that's a 19th, 20th century convention. It's kind of like public school, there was, there was no idea of sitting 30 youngsters down for 8 hours a day and teaching them how to read and write. The parochial schools were very, mostly, for the elite and for those who, were able to afford it, as Isaac Newton always talked about in his stuff, of
I've only heard of his equations or learned his equations, not his actual, personal collection of musings. So.
yeah, he his father is fascinating story. When he was young, his father passed away very early in Newton's life, and his father owned a lot of property. He wasn't cash wealthy, he was land wealthy, I guess. But the priest who helped bury him eventually, or not eventually, but like quickly, marries his mother, Newton's mom. And the priest evidently was not a nice guy. And obviously this is after split and all that kind of stuff, where priests are doing those sorts of things. So Newton always, according, to what we can reconstruct from his writings and that kind of stuff, did not like going back home. So when Cambridge closed down and he was 23 and he was already a professor, and has to go back home to basically do remote learning. And he goes back home and ends up writing the Principia, and yeah, so that was kind of his, Google Meet or Zoom call of the day. So he was writing that for his students to answer the question of why does the moon go around the earth, and comes up with calculus and all sorts of wonderful things there in the Principia. And all the time he's hating being back in his mom's home with the priest, who I think also passed away pretty early. So maybe his mom was wise in some other ways, but it's a fun story. But yeah, I think about that a lot with aid and our current situation, and comparing that to the ancient world, because we're, at least here in the US, we're seeing kind of this, I won't say rejuvenation of organized religion, but there's definitely a lot more kind of cultural talk about, the role of church, and young people sort of looking back to the church for meaning. And yeah, so it's interesting to see, that element kind of being tangled up with some of the political stuff we have going on here in the United States with our current administration, and things like USAID and Medicaid and those issues that we're haggling about right now, and Congress with trying to figure out what kind of cuts we're going to have to those things so that we can give more tax cuts to people who don't really need it.
Yeah,
So
it
it's,
really feels like a kicking away the ladder kind of a thing. It's like not so much lift everyone up, but from the outside at least, it looks like a bunch of rich people who are like, well, let's make it as difficult as possible for other people to rise to our station, because we'll always have the ability to, fund kids through college or things like that. It seems, I don't know whether the opposite of altruism is misanthropy. I'm not sure.
yeah, and you see things like the Gates Foundation. Bill Gates announced, here's the hard date. We're shutting down in, I think, 2040. When originally Gates kind of said he wanted that to be a perpetual, ongoing thing, because, he had, hundreds of billions of dollars or whatever it was, and he wanted to give it all away. And now he's kind of dialing that back, and we see kind of this rise of things like Jeff Bezos with his, incredibly huge yacht, at Monaco for the F1 race, and made with teak, like teak wood that was illegally harvested in Malaysia. But he's a rich guy, so who cares? Or
I could
Elon.
only imagine the jeremiad that you would get about the extraordinarily wealthy if they had these kinds of extravagances back in what 5th century BCE at times around when the Hebrew Bible was, beginning to be assembled or being stitched together. That might be the more appropriate, was being uniformized or homologated, being homologated. So that's a term we use in the automotive industry, where it's like, okay, so you got your standards in the US, but we have to, slightly tweak things just to make them fit for Canada. So yeah, you have these
Right.
different sources, JEPD, whatever, and then everything comes together in a this beautifully, this dazzling array of different pieces, which fit together. They're not seamless, but you can see the through line, kind of.
When you get to issues like that, especially in the Hebrew Bible, there's not a lot of love for people who are amassing vast sums of wealth and not really sharing that with the wider community. But I'm a late dater, so for me, I think it's we see that, like you said,
Through the
interweaving. And
Maccabean period, maybe, or
yeah, exactly. I would say the Maccabeans into the Hasmonean period, even. I think the idea of the formation of the Old Testament, really, or First Testament or Hebrew Bible, however we want to say that, really doesn't come to fruition until around the time the Septuagint is put together. But
Right.
before that, I think the Hasmoneans and just a little bit before the Maccabean period really had a huge impact on that, of saying, okay, we need kind of this identity. And I'll resist saying national identity, because there were no nations as we know them. But so I've always been a very late dater when it comes to that, even though I do think parts of, like you said, documentary hypothesis and that kind of stuff, which is somewhat, can be out of vogue these days, but I still love it.
I
I
think the
think parts of
supplementary hypothesis is its leading sort of contender, where it's not so much
it's
linear, but it's kind of a, I don't know, like all the stuff coming around Saturn to form the rings, kind of. It's like, it's not just
Yeah,
one by one.
exactly.
It's kind of just like, it's this beautiful
Right.
mishmash.
I
I think, oops, so go ahead.
No, it's good. I was just gonna say, and that's kind of the fun of looking back on the 20th century, with biblical scholarship, because you've got form criticism and redaction criticism and all these approaches. But I think what really has taken hold is it's more kind of like Brevard Childs from Yale, his canonical criticism of saying we don't really know where these different strands of the Torah, the Pentateuch, came from, but we have it as we've received it, so that's what we need to do scholarship on. And that kind of reader response mode really was such a big player in the early part of the 21st century. And now we're kind of seeing the pendulum swing back the other way, so we are seeing more interest back in things like the documentary idea, which I'm glad to see, because I just happened to go through seminary and div school and all that stuff when that was very looked down upon. I was like, no, we got to talk about JEDP. So yeah, the Postmodern Project it's sort of like new atheism. Like, it's really kind of coming to an end in some ways, and its importance. And people are talking about re-enchantment of the global consciousness, and people thinking about religion, or think pe you know people thinking about objectivity rather than just pure subjectivity, and those sorts of things. So
It's a pendulum swinging kind of a thing.
yeah
I
and yeah no go ahead
remember reading what was it, when the New Atheists, there were like four guys, Dawkins and Hitchens, a couple other guys whose name I don't remember offhand. And I remember reading both of their books and thinking, well, these are pretty big critiques. I still perceived value in the various literatures that they impugned. But then I read, was it? It was Christopher Hedges. He's kind of a journalist, I think, based in Canada now. He was part of the New York Times team that did coverage of the Iraq War, won a Pulitzer for that. And he had actually done seminary, I think, at Harvard, maybe, or Divinity School at Harvard.
Not
And
sure.
he wrote a book. I think the current title is like When Atheism Becomes Religion. When I bought it, it was like, I don't believe in atheists, but in a very systematic way, he said, well, look, all these critiques of that the atheists are giving, they are as poorly targeted as, say, Christian nationalist critiques of evolution or something. There's like you find the worst example, impugn the whole thing based on the one bad example you can find. It was a very I don't know, it was a very persuasive book. And as a result of which, I recycled my prior Hitchens and Dawkins book. I would have given them to a bookstore, but I tend to scribble in the margins, and apparently bookstores don't like that. But
Ah,
it was
that's the best
just
part.
such an well, yeah, that's so but at least the ones over here don't. But I am yeah, I'm enthused that there would be less rigidity, maybe, because you're talking about new atheists. There was a study I saw in the past couple of days, one of the social media networks I'm on, maybe it was Reddit, about like supernatural belief as per current study, based in North America, probably, where the belief of like some sort of a creative spirit or some sort of soul kind of a phenomenon in nature was about the same across all studied age groups from like 30 to 70, something like that. So I would imagine that maybe there's a recurring human affinity for some sort of value, some sort of I don't know about holiness, but something beyond the I don't know the ruthless individuality of humans only, and maybe the rise of various new age groups is basically just a different form of intentional community of congregation around uniform human beliefs, which I don't know, somehow fits the moment better than established religions do. In fairness, there have been a lot of scandals around incumbent religions, let's say. So
Yeah, certainly.
I could see there's a lot of baggage there, and you know, appropriately so. But the study made me think that the vision of a world of purely rational type people, it's always been a utopian imaginary, you know, project. It always will be. It's like it's not just STEM what carries us to the future. STEM is wonderful, but you need the humanities as well, because we're not machines, we're human, right?
Yeah, and that's such a big part of like in my program right now. A few of my professors are really into that. Sean Kelly, who's Canadian, he's lives in San Francisco now, but he's from Ottawa and talks a lot about consciousness and the Gaia hypothesis and those sorts of things. And he's kind of a leading scholar in the world of integral ecology and you know, not just sort of environmental science, but thinking about you know the place of the human and the global consciousness and what that means. I have another professor named Matt Siegel who's a younger guy and he's amazing. And he does a lot of work on Alfred North Whitehead, but also on just the concept of panpsychism, which is this complicated topic. I'll put a link down in the show notes for everybody, but panpsychism kind of is this idea that there's, you know, a layer of consciousness or enchantment or you know, divinity, if you will, sort of out there. It's almost like the Force in Star Wars, but it's kind of based on process theology or
So it's
process philosophy.
like a non-mechanism. There's something beyond the brute mechanics of, you know, ingest food,
Yeah, right,
remove waste,
exactly.
survive, you know, kill, eat, avoid being killed.
Yeah, and Rupert Sheldrake is a great philosopher who has done a lot of work on this and the notion of embodiment, but what that means in terms of what that means in terms of you know our sensing of the world. And he talks about sense and sensuousness and in terms of being human and well, you know what that might mean for an electron or what that might mean for a mushroom or you know the you know microbial you know stuff in our gut. I read a book last year called The Blind Spot by Evan Thompson and Adam Frank and Marcelo Gleiser, I believe, and they're all in California as well, but they are primarily STEM related professors. I think one's a physicist. You know, and I come from 20 years in the classroom of teaching physics and physical science and that kind of stuff before this. So it's kind of a fun jumping off point for me, and I could talk for hours about this. But that book, The Blind Spot, I highly recommend to people. It's written in a very approachable manner, and it came out last year. But basically, it's like why science can't ignore the human experience, and they delve into Whitehead and process thought, which I'm a big proponent of. And the idea that the universe as we know it is this thing that is sort of constantly changing and changing with us, and we're changing it in some ways. So to come at the world from a purely reductionist kind of materialistic, physics or chemistry or even anthropological sense, like you're missing out on a part of the human experience in that way. You don't have to be a person of faith or something like that to get it, but it's one of those things, one of those important works, I guess, that I think that are coming out now, where people are saying, okay, we've got artificial intelligence, and we're soon going to have artificial generative intelligence, and not only what do we do with these tools, but how does that play into what it means to be human? And I think we're going to see people really questioning, that concept of religion. And Matt Siegel, my professor, talks a lot about how, there could be religions that pop up that, find a source of faith in these things, because they're sort of magical. I won't say entities, but they're magical experiences so far. And that's only going to continue because AI is the worst right now will ever be, right? So as these things proliferate, what does that mean for the understanding of human consciousness or the understanding of reductionistic physics, which I come out of? What does that mean for religion? So I think we're at this really, really interesting inflection point. That's another reason I wanted to go ahead and knock out this PhD and join that conversation, because I think the next 10 years are going to be pivotal for so many aspects of, our lives and the lives of our children.
Well, it sounds a little bit like the distinction between genetics and the more recent, it's not a replacement, but an additive theory or observation of epigenetic traumas, for example,
Yeah,
where
exactly. Right.
it's not I mean, our DNA is encoded through genetics, but additional factors or stressors can influence for multiple generations in mice at least, how I don't know, the behavior tendencies of offspring, things like that. And in a similar way, I'm the physical laws of the universe will be as observed, but at least in our interaction with them, how we how we what sentiments or inference we draw, how we react to how different people react to different things, seems like the kind of thing where we would have that additive layer of understanding to layer on top.
Yeah, exactly. I mentioned Rupert Sheldrake earlier, but he just did a or there was a piece published on his Substack, very similar to that. And I'm forgetting the title right now. I'll link it up again in the notes. But he basically is asking the question: is biology me mechanical? And sort of goes into that idea and looks at various species. I think he's a microbiologist or a biologist by trade before, but he, is also kind of in the philosophical side. And it's a fascinating study. It's long, but it's well worth a read. And sort of goes into that and examining, that seeming bifurcation that now is sort of, I think, coming back as we get towards the middle half of this century, and we face everything from, climate issues to species extinction events, and our own precarious situation with human condition of war and all those things, and what we might be facing in the near future with everything from flooding to mass migration and food insecurity and water insecurity. So it's I don't know. I think it's a very important time to be raising these questions for sure. And to go back and look at Plato and say, okay, Maybe Whitehead was right, and all of Western philosophy are just footnotes to Plato, because I
Footnotes
think
to Plato.
that's,
I know the expression.
which is actually Matt Siegel's blog's name. I was just pulling his thing up for the notes. So it reminded me of that. But yeah, I think, that ancient wisdom, whether it's inside of a religious text or, whether it's in Aristotle and Plato, I think there's a lot to be said there about sort of finding answers or potential pathways for us as we look at all this. But my big thing is, and I've never said this before, but we need to slow down a little bit and let the humanities sort of have these conversations with the sciences and find that, not middle ground, but find that metaphysical approach that recognizes us as humans and, recognizes that embodiment and what that means. And I don't know, it feels like we're speeding towards something, and we'll find out very soon if we keep hurtling down that path one way or the other.
It does seem like from the outside, we have a bunch of very enthusiastic people, I don't know, zealots maybe, for artificial intelligence, for AGI, who have access to large funders who are trying to push us into some sort of like a millenarianism, like some apocalyptic, oh, the machine, the artificial intelligence will take over. And it doesn't always seem as if they're doesn't always seem as if they're cheering for the humans in this eventual dynamic. And that just reinvents the whole apocalypticism in religion phenomenon, right? It's, we have pains and sufferings in the current world, some magical thing will happen, and then the world for us will be better, or maybe the world for only us will be better. And I do, I guess the one thing I do wonder on the AI side is that for, I guess, in prior years and decades, if an organization like your guys, your the NRA, I guess, was really big for a while, they could send out these newsletters with form letters for people to fill in and say, please don't do such and such legislation. And that's I'm sure that had an effect, but they are form letters, so you could easily see this was one central idea being pushed to a bunch of people, being targeting legislators. But I would imagine, if it hasn't happened already, that a determined person, like one person with the software, the LLMs at their disposal, could create 1,000 different looking letters and figure out how to time, the date stamp or whatever, come up with names that might even coincide with people in that person's riding or county, and then one person could give a much bigger and yet still very deceptive impact as to what the popular opinion is, right? It's I remember from my classics classes that one reason it's thought that Athens became a democracy for a while was that Athens depended on its navy, which meant that like every grown male who was physically fit had to occasionally cooperate to man these vessels, whereas Sparta remained an oligarchy because it was just the rich people fighting. And so like why do we need to, let the non-soldiers, non-contributors, have a say in government? And so, I wonder if artificial intelligence sort of pulls that pendulum more towards wealthier people with the resources to completely spam or, was it AstroTurf? Just get their impressions out there, crowding out the mere manual production of, letters to the editor and whatnot.
Yeah, exactly. And sadly, I think our timer here is going to run up on the recording, but I think that's a great place to leave the people.